You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
The great hope is called direct air capture. International agencies already count DAC, as it's called, among solutions after overshooting the 1.5 degree safety mark. Two carbon capture plants are starting operations in Iceland, but how real is it? If anybody knows, it is Howard J. Herzog. He is a senior research engineer in the MIT Energy Initiative. Herzog is an expert in the field with many papers published about DAC. Now with three other senior and principal researchers, scientists at MIT, Herzog published a startling conclusion in a commentary titled, Getting Real About Capturing Carbon from the Air. From the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Howard Herzog, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Right. So if I want to build something or go anywhere or do much of anything, I just need the right machine. Machines seem to solve everything. Can we call direct air capture a machine? How does it work?
Well, it is a machine or a couple of machines. I call it more of a process that air comes in to your facility and then leaves with the CO2 taking out of it. And it's basically done in two steps. The first step is something that absorbs the CO2 from the air onto some sort of sorbent, which is some sort of chemical. It grabs the CO2 out of the air. And then in the second step, you release that CO2 and capture it, so you have highly concentrated CO2 that you can then, in general, what you would do is put it in deep geologic formations. Some people are also trying to use it in different ways, but the uses for that CO2 are fairly small, and the capacity to put it underground is quite large.
So in whatever planning we allegedly have, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the COP mechanism, the governments, the private corporations, are they counting on direct air capture of carbon dioxide in our future plans?
So groups like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change summarize the literature and write these assessment reports. And they feed into the climate negotiations, and they are looked at by policymakers. So they look at what's in the literature. And you have a lot of groups around the world. I don't know the exact number, maybe around 20 major ones that do these energy economic evaluations, look at our emissions and our economics running out to the end of the century, and they look at different scenarios. And in the past 5 years or so, what we call negative emissions, or taking CO2 out of the atmosphere, it has creeped into these models and therefore is being reported by the IPCC. In fact, to meet the targets, whether it's 1.5 degrees C or 2 degrees C stabilization, because we are not reducing our emissions great enough, it looks like we're going to overshoot it. So most of these scenarios that we look at overshoot our target and need to come down by taking CO2 out of the air. The way to do that, there's a whole bunch of ways, some biological, some chemical, to do that. But recently, what's called direct air capture has sort of become a hot topic. And one reason is things that take CO2 out of the air, like planting trees. Well, that's nice, but what happens 10 or 20 years down the road if the forest burns down or there's a pestilence and the trees die? It's not that permanent. What you see from direct air capture is what people look at as a really high-quality carbon removal credit. You can measure it. You can actually see the CO2 you take out of the air. It's immediate, and storing it in geological formations is essentially a permanent solution of keeping it out of the atmosphere.
How far has the industry progressed?
You can go back in the literature and see some of the first references to direct air capture and sort of the way it's being implemented today, going back to around the year 2000 or so. So it's been around 25 years, but it's only been in the past, what I would say, less than 10 years that it's really being looked at seriously with significant investment going into the field. And what we see today are several pilot plants, but on the scope of things, these pilot plants are small. So we're putting out, the world's putting out, I forget the exact number, 40, 50 billion tons of CO2 or CO2 equivalent a year of greenhouse gases. And to really operate on that scale, you need to be operating at the billion ton a year level. Right now, the biggest direct air capture plant in operation is 4,000 tons a year, and that's up in Iceland by a company called Climeworks. Oxy, the oil company down in Texas, is constructing a plant that will become the world's biggest if it goes online. It's supposed to go online mid-next year. That would be 250,000 tons a year. So we see some examples of this out there, but they're at a very, very small level compared to what we have to do to really scale up the technology to have an impact on climate change.
Yes, I looked into the DAC plant, the Mammoth plant it's called, in Iceland, operated by Climeworks. They just opened part of the new facility in May 2024. The nameplate capacity for carbon capture is 36,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide a year. Just back of envelope calculations on my part finds we would need about a million of those to even stay with current emissions. Talk to us about the problems of scale when actually trying to build our way out of carbon overshoot.
Let me first say there are other methods, and there's certain pathways that I think are more promising than direct air capture for doing it. I think all the methods can make some sort of contribution doing it, but one of the biggest barriers for direct air capture itself is the amount of energy it needs to take the CO2 out of the air. It's fairly energy intensive. If it was next to a power plant, a coal-fired power plant, and that coal-fired power plant was feeding the electricity into the direct air capture plant, for every molecule of CO2 taken out of the air by the direct air capture plant, the coal plant will put up 1.2 molecules of CO2, which, of course, does us no good. So you really need low-carbon energy to run these things. Unfortunately, we don't have enough low-carbon energy today to do everything that we want. We still have a lot of oil and gas in our electricity production system. We want to increase our low-carbon energy to fuel our electric vehicles. We need to power our heat pumps. People talk about green hydrogen. You need electricity for that, or carbon-free electricity for that. So there's a lot of uses for this. So that's one barrier to scaling it up. And the other barrier, which, you know, was a main thrust of the article we wrote, was the cost of doing this.
Yes, one DAC design requires a giant concrete and steel structure 3 stories high, 3 miles long. You wonder if these machines can even overcome the carbon used in their construction and operation and maintenance.
Well, at this point, that is, you know, the life cycle is an issue on that. You know, if for, say, 30 or 40 years in the future and we've really decarbonized our energy system, then those materials will be also become decarbonized. But today, finding carbon-free energy to run the plant and also to make the materials needed by the plant is the problem. And all of this traces back. The real challenge is the low concentration of carbon dioxide in the air. So even though from climate reasons we have too much carbon dioxide in the air, from a chemical process, it's very, very small. It's about, 420 ppm today, or 0.042%. And that makes it difficult, not only difficult to remove, but you need to process a lot of air just to grab one ton. So to get thousands of tons or millions of tons and then up to billions of tons, that's a lot of air to process, and that takes big machines and lots of energy.
And you found studies that may be used in government planning with unrealistic projections for both the cost per ton and the total CO2 capture that could be expected from DAC. Do you want to tell us about this disconnect, particularly the cost per ton angle?
Yes. So, as we say, Climeworks, which has a plant operating in Iceland and a second plant that you mentioned, the Mammoth plant, coming online. Actually, you can go to their website, and as an individual, you can buy carbon credits from them. The cost of those carbon credits, they don't talk about it in dollars per ton, but it's an easy conversion to make, is $1,500 per ton of CO2, which is very large. A lot of high-tech companies and, say, airline companies are trying to buy credits, and and even though a lot of these numbers aren't public, it seems like the numbers they're paying are the high $100 per ton, approaching $1,000 per ton. This is very expensive when you look at the price in the European emissions trading system. Their numbers are about $100 a ton to keep CO2 out of the atmosphere. So when you're talking on the order of $1,000 a ton, it's very expensive. And, you know, is that really sustainable to pay it? So you got to get the numbers down. And so people, of course, you know, these companies are pitching to industry and they say, we can get the cost down. And they absolutely can get the cost down. But the question is, how far can they get the cost down? And a lot of them are saying we get down to even $100 a ton. And the U.S. DOE has a target of $100 a ton for carbon removal from all the different various methods. And that number is sort of stuck, you know. So you see a lot in the range of $100 to $300. But from our engineering analysis, based on how much air you have to capture, how much energy you need to use, and all of this, we just find that unrealistic. How far they can get down, anybody's guess. I made a guess in an article I wrote a couple of years ago saying maybe by 2030 we can get to $600 to $1,000 range. People say I'm way too conservative. They're more bullish than that. But I say let's wait and see. I haven't seen any evidence to make me revise my thing. And I'll tell you how some of these things work. So people say, okay, there's something called learning by doing, and it's fairly well established that as a technology matures and you learn by doing, the price will come down. So you have a price today, and you keep doing it, and price comes down. The problem is we're so early in direct air capture that we don't know what the real price is today. And, in fact, a lot of times projects that are in the early stage, prices increase. So one problem with direct air capture, you got to harden it to the weather. Well, a lot of times in the laboratory, you're doing cost estimates. You don't really, you sort of ignore that. But then when you go out in the field, okay, now I got to add this cost. So lots of costs get added. So we don't know what the cost is today. And secondly, we don't know how fast that cost will come down. And what people do on learning curve, they assume, all right, I'm going to sell so much quantity and the price will come down so much percent. But I would claim that that's a fairly empirical thing. We've seen curves from, say, solar energy and the like, but that doesn't mean that same curve is going to apply here. So what they'll do, and I've seen several papers on this, they'll say, okay, here's the price today. It's going to come down, and the price will end up here. Well, you know, theoretically, all right, but in reality, I don't believe it. And the other thing is, they don't take the constraints into the model. There's minimum energy you're going to need. There's minimum amount of steel and concrete you're going to need. And we don't know all those prices. So we don't, you know, I get into debates with people. What's the price of carbon-free electricity in 2050? No one really knows. And people say, look at the solar and wind, so cheap today, you can get it for this and this. But yet, while we have cheap solar and wind, electricity prices in aggregate go up because solar and wind are intermittent, and the electricity we want to use for most of our things, including the direct air capture plants, have to be 24/7.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest from MIT, energy specialist Howard Herzog. Data centers are becoming major power consumers, threatening to gobble up any gains from efficiency or electrification of transport. What have you heard about big tech investments or plans for direct air capture to overcome the big climate risk of, say, the AI revolution?
I don't know. I haven't heard anything directly with data centers. I know that some data centers are trying to revive nuclear power plants. But my background for most of my work here the past 35 years has been on carbon capture and storage from point sources. So that actually is a pretty good fit with data centers, that you can have, say, a gas power plant, put carbon capture on the exhaust. A lot easier to capture that carbon when the concentration of the CO2 is over 100 times more than in the air. And then we can put it in the ground, and you have 24/7 carbon-free electricity from a natural gas plant with carbon capture and storage.
And one of the competitors for DAC and a lot of science and government subsidies went into this is bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, which is called BECCS. And I looked at the Drax wood-burning power station in the UK, for example, and found a report that its real carbon cost might be higher than burning UK coal. You said that you had kind of a preferred solution going here. Would you like to tell us about that?
I'm a big fan of BECCS. As I say, I haven't looked at the Drax. Well, the Drax plant does not have carbon capture and storage on it at this point. What they did was convert from coal to biomass or wood, and they're shipping a lot of that wood from the southeast of the United States. But basically, if you burn biomass in a power plant and capture the CO2, put it in the ground, what you've essentially done is the trees take the CO2 out of the air. When we burn it, the CO2 is released, but we capture it, put it in the ground. So now you actually have a net of from the air to the ground, or what we call negative emissions, with the BECCS plant. And if those negative emissions can be monetized, it could be a fairly cost-effective way. Numbers that we did a paper a number of years ago, and the number we put for large-scale BECCS is about $240 a ton of CO2. The key there is you have to have sustainable biomass coming in. So the ideal thing would be to have your biomass supply, say, a large forest, where you're harvesting biomass from that forest, but only at the rate that that forest is absorbing the CO2 from the air. And, you know, the question is how much forest space is there, or how much, or there could be also other agricultural products, how much is there? I'm not an expert at that, but my talking with people in the industry and doing some reading is the opportunities, I think, are much greater than a lot of people think and are very significant for doing that. So that's actually one negative emission technology that I think we're underutilizing. And these models I talked about earlier that looked at negative emissions, they actually started with BECCS. That was the one they first used, and only recently has sort of direct air capture become, should I say, the flavor of the month.
Well, yes, supposing we really go for DAC, and despite budget slashing and huge government debts, the big governments embark on an emergency plan to build machines that suck carbon out of the air. Would this cost billions or trillions?
Well, let's just do a quick calculation. If we're going to do 1 billion tons a year, and we need to take a cost. So if you took the $100 a ton, you're talking about $100 billion a year. If you take the $1,000 thing, we're talking about $1 trillion a year. And that's for 1 billion tons. Right now, we have about a 40 billion ton problem worldwide. So
very expensive. So you've published about getting real about direct air capture. Have you had any pushback or replies of people criticizing or cheering you?
Some. But, you know, people that push back never really want to discuss the underlying technology. So I'm a chemical engineer. I have in the past designed plants, and that's what these are. They're type of chemical plant, and there's fundamentals there. And before I wrote this article, I wrote an article a couple years ago, much more detailed on the engineering. No one has taken me up on the engineering. You know, they don't question that. They just say things like, well, Our energy is only going to cost 1 or 2 cents a kilowatt hour, so that's going to be cheap. People are starting to say, well, we're not going to have these big machines. We're just going to have the sorbent sitting out in the air, and then we'll do it, and then we'll save money. And, you know, none of these things, from an engineering point, I feel are realistic. There's a lot of momentum. I just saw, like 2 days ago, Heirloom, another direct air capture company, just got a lot of funding from, I can't remember all the companies, but a number of companies. So money's still going into this. People want it, you know. People don't want to miss the boat, but I just look at it as an engineer and say, you know, these are the fundamentals, and I've worked on carbon capture from point source for 35 years, which is a much easier problem, and we still, you know, there's facilities out there for it, but it's not a lot. This is difficult. It's, you know, so much cheaper to reduce our emissions at this point than to try to take it out of the air. I just think we're taking our eye off the ball, and we should just double down. I wrote a book on carbon dioxide removal. It's going to be published by MIT Press coming out in August. And my last sentence in the book is, the best way to remove carbon dioxide from the air is not put it into the air in the first place.
Well, we'll look forward to your book next August. I hope to get some sort of notice about that or see it coming up, and we'll take a look. From MIT, we have been talking with Howard J. Herzog, a senior research engineer in the MIT Energy Initiative. He and his colleagues published Getting Real About Capturing Carbon from the Air on September 20th, 2024. You can find links and more to follow up in my show blog. It's published every Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Howard, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Okay, my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.